So, of course, they all went. It was a very strange occasion, with the six of them sitting around a long, narrow table in the big domed room at the top of the clock tower, dinner by candlelight under the false stars of the deputy chairman's planetarium. The conversation was perfectly civil, but strained. A curious tension underlay everything, setting everyone's nerves on edge. Almost everyone's. Toga didn't seem particularly tense or nervous, and the deputy chairman himself was the picture of calm, a pleasant and relaxed host, inquiring after everyone's satisfaction with the dishes on offer and presiding over the wine serving with a gracious ease. "Of course, I know you're all supposed to be too young for wine with dinner," he said with a conspiratorial wink, "but for this group I think an exception can be made." Part of the awkwardness came from the fact that, in front of every place setting, there was a rose signet ring sitting on a small pewter salver. After the apparent end of the tournament and their strange, fearful vigil on the observation balcony, which gave them no enlightenment or peace, the counselors had removed theirs, put them away or discarded them as the peak struck them. The fact that they were being presented with them again did not lend any of the five notable peace of mind. After dinner, with dessert having been made available to those who wanted it, Deputy Chairman Akio Otori returned to his seat at the head of the table, folded his hands in front of him, and said, "Now that dinner's over with, I suppose it's time we got down to business. I expect you're all wondering just what happened to the grand tournament, since revolution has not come to the world." "I assumed," Jury said calmly, "that the one given the power to do so simply chose not to exercise it." Akio glanced at her, his green eyes momentarily narrowing, but his voice was pleasant as he said, "Ah, so you remember that there was a winner then. A curious side effect of the tournament's failure has been that not many people around here seem to remember her anymore." Mikikaworu blinked, looking puzzled. "I remember someone won," he said, sounding as though it had only just occurred to him how strange this was, "but not who it was." "Just that it wasn't one of us," said Nanami, the tone of her voice picking up the same thread of mingled dawning realization and confusion. "But how is that possible? We're the student council. There aren't any other duelists." "Not anymore," Akio told her. "But Miss Arisugawa seems to remember the one who is no longer with us, and I'm curious as to how that is." Jury gave him a smile that held no warmth whatsoever, and replied simply, "I've always had a good memory for faces." "Indeed," said Akio, his own smile conceding this small defeat. "Well," he added, rising from his chair, "for the sake of the rest of you, who seem to be suffering from this curious aftershock of the tournament's unfortunate end, let me see if I can jog your memories somewhat." The planetarium projector in the center of the room clicked, shifted, and suddenly the room wasn't a planetarium anymore. Instead, the duelists gasped as it drew a remarkably realistic, detailed representation of the Academy's dueling platform in the sky around them, then populated it. In a ghostly montage that moved around them as though they weren't there, they were shown themselves, each dueling in turn, each losing, each to the same black-clad, pink-haired opponent. That opponent, lunging forward in the sudden explosive strike which they all now remembered had been her signature to end each duel, suddenly froze as if time had stopped around her, hovering extended in the middle of her leap, the tip of her blade nearly touching the chest of the phantom Toga she faced, a look of mingled determination and anger on her face. Akio went to stand next to her, mimed putting a hand on her shoulder, and said with a wry edge in his voice, "I'm sure you all remember Utena Tenjo now." "Indeed I do," said Toga, looking a bit peevish. "Now explain why, a moment ago, I didn't." "As I said," Akio replied, apparently a side effect of the failure of the tournament. You see, Miss Tenjo here had won, had been declared the one who would revolutionize the world. But she failed to do so. The room changed again, becoming a curious sort of analog of itself. Exactly how the observers could tell that, none of them were sure, but there it was. And there was Utrina again, standing in an on-guard position, her blade raised. There was another Evakio there, too, one dressed in the formal uniform of the Grand Duelist. He, too, had a sword. He, too, held it at the ready. "You already know that I am the end of the world," Akio told them. More formally, the Grand Duelist, the one charged by the Pillar with coordinating the Grand Tournament to replace our world's lost Prince Dios. At the contest's end, it appeared that, despite the obvious oddity involved, that replacement would be Utena Tenjo. Unfortunately... In eerie silence, the illusory Utena swept into motion, attacking the other Akio with a savage intensity that was unlike her. All the duelists had faced her, more than once. All, now that the veil had been lifted from their memories of her, remembered the way she fought. Her style was reckless, untutored, unpredictable, and seemed at times to be inspired by forces beyond mortal understanding. But it was not savage. Aside from the peculiar affectation of her uniform, she had been a remarkably well-adjusted, level-headed girl, strong of character and extremely balanced, considering how madly disordered her surroundings tended to be. No, this was not Utena as they remembered her. Her face was twisted with hatred, her blue eyes glittering with it, as she drove herself against Akio's guard with a furious intensity. This was no rose duel. This was murderously real. The recorded image of the deputy chairman was fighting for his life. They fought for several minutes, mouths moving in silent dialogue, until finally, with a look on his face that clearly said he hadn't wanted to be forced to this, Akio trapped and broke her sword. Miki Kaworu, knowing from experience where it must have come from, winced, sucking breath between his teeth. And indeed, Utena reeled, her free hand clutching at her chest for a moment. Then, her pupils shrinking with rage, she collected herself, smashed Akio's blade out of his hand with what remained of her own, and drove him against the wall, the jagged, broken end of her blade dimpling the flesh of his throat. From somewhere off to the side, Anthihimemia, the Rose Bride, appeared, grabbing at Utena's arm, obviously pleading for her brother's life. Utena turned, removing the broken blade from Akio's throat, and struck her a backhanded blow with the fist that held the sword's brass-barred grip, knocking her clean to the ground. All the duelists winced a bit at that. "You see how unbalanced she was by this point," Akio observed. "I'm sure you all recall how protective she was of the Rose Bride. That was not a thing she would have done had her mind been whole and stable. Even in the state she was in, she realized its enormity a moment later." Indeed, as he spoke, Utena looked horrified, dropped her broken sword to the ground and knelt by the fallen Rose Bride, shaking her shoulders, the madness in her eyes replaced by tears. Then she turned, face marred by that same crazed rage again, spat some silent words at Akio, and bent her head in concentration. Akio, his face horrified, lunged forward, clearly shouting for her to stop. But there was a blaze of light, and both women were gone. The phantom of Akio Tori stood for a moment, looking down at the spot where they had been, watching the fragments of Utena's sword dissolve into golden sparks and vanish too. His head bowed, an expression of mingled frustration and worry on his face. The image faded, replaced by the familiar starry false sky again. A stunned hush settled onto the room, broken only by Nanami Kiryu asking, "So, what went wrong?" Akio shook his head, his face sad. "I'm not sure. Perhaps her mind simply couldn't absorb the shock of what she was becoming. Becoming this world's prince, I'm told it's one step short of ascending to godhood. It could be that the power simply unhinged her." All I know is that as the Rose Bride and I invested her with it, she became enraged, irrational, and turned on us. She called me terrible things. I'm glad the mechanism which recorded what passed could only record the sights. What she said isn't something I ever want to hear again. Except, of course, that I will hear it in my memory forever. He sat down in his place at the table, put his fingertips to his forehead, and sighed long and deeply. "Do you know where she went?" asked Toga. "No," Akio replied. "Not exactly. I don't think she had a master plan. Just a desire to get as far away from me as possible." "Hmm," said Toga, not exactly sympathetically. "What do you want with us, then?" "You are the Otori Academy Student Council," Akio told them, "and I am its Grand Duelist. The tournament is in disarray. The Prince Designate has lost her mind and fled, her investiture incomplete, though manifestly she has some of the power. Witness the manner in which she quit this chamber." "That would be bad enough, such a dangerously unhinged creature with such power roaming the world." "But she's kidnapped the Rose Bride into the bargain. If she somehow manages to force Anthe to complete her investiture, this world will be revolutionized by a mind gone mad." He regarded them each in turn and said with an unnerving calmness, "I don't think I have to spell out for you why that outcome is worth any effort spent averting it." Akio rose to his feet, spread his hands upon the table, and leaned forward. "You five are the duelists of the Rose, the chosen champions of Sephiroth. In the name of the Pillar, I, your Grand Duelist, call upon you to take up your swords again and go forth. You must scour this world for the Rose Bride, find her, wrest her from her captor, and return her to the Academy. Only with her safe and protected within these walls can the damage wrought by Utena Tenjo's failure to the world, to the ancient enchantments of the Duelist's Code, to Miss Tenjo herself, be repaired." "And then?" Sionji wondered. "Who knows?" Akio replied. "If Tenjo can be saved, the damage done by her incomplete investiture reversed, she may yet take her proper place as this world's new prince. If not, then it will be one of you. Perhaps the one who finds her, depending on the circumstances. I can't say for sure. This situation is unprecedented in the history of the Academy." "Why have you waited so long to ask for our help?" Toga inquired. "One would think, if it were so dire, you would have called us together immediately it happened, set us to searching while the trail was warm." "There is no trail," Akio told him. "You saw how they disappeared. At any rate, though, you're right. It was foolish of me not to call on you sooner. I tried to handle the situation myself, using my own resources. After all the rigors of the tournament, I was loath to impose upon you all again to help clean up my own mistake. But my attempts to rectify the situation remotely have failed, and I cannot leave the school to search for them myself." Nanami looked doubtful of the evidence of her own ears. "You expect us to drop everything we're doing right before finals week and go to the ends of the world?" Toga snickered a little at her wording. She ignored him. "Looking for your sister. And then what are we supposed to do if we find her? Suppose Tenjo's still out of her mind, are we expected to kill her?" "If you have to," Akio replied flatly, making the blonde's blood run cold. "Understand, I don't want her dead," he went on in a slightly gentler tone. "She's important to me. Before she lost her grip on reality, we were friends. If she can be saved, even if her investiture cannot be completed and someone else must take her place, I want that for her. But if the only way to free Anthe and put right the damage to the world is to kill her, then yes, I expect her to be killed. A duelist's first responsibility is to the code and to Sephiro. Friendship, compassion, even love must bend before this duty. That holds as true for you as it does for me. Miki Kaworu triggered his watch and stood up, his face stony. I don't know what kind of game you're playing this time, Mr. Chairman, he said calmly, but I want nothing to do with it. Mr. Kaworu, said Akio, surprise in his voice, I would have thought you would be the first to take back your signet and fight, for my sister's sake. At one time you wanted so badly to be her champion that you were ready to risk your life. I am still her friend, Miki replied, not quailing before Akio's cool green gaze. I still act in her interests. Then I don't understand. Why refuse to help her? Because your story is a lie, said Miki flatly. Miss Himemiya wasn't abducted from this tower in a flash of light. She packed a suitcase and walked away from this school under her own power, of her own free will. I spoke to her at the gate and watched her go. I don't know why you want us to go out into the world and drag her back, but it's clear to me that it isn't for her benefit. An artifact of the memory distortion produced by the failure of the prince's investiture, Akio said. Probably caused by your closeness to my sister and Tenjo's unconscious knowledge that you would be the first to seek Anthe if she simply disappeared. What you spoke to was a phantom, Mr. Kaworu, an illusion, projected by Tenjo's damaged mind through the lens of the prince's power. I have seen such phenomena before. Miki shook his head. We spoke of things Miss Tenjo would have no knowledge of, he replied. Your rationalization does not impress me. Slowly, deliberately, Miki raised his wine glass, drained it, and overturned it, placing it down squarely over the rose signet on its salver before his place. I'm not fool enough to think I can oppose you openly, Mr. Chairman, said he, but you'll get no help from me. Remember this, though. I still have my original signet, safely stored away. If you do get someone to drag Miss Himemiya back here, I'll put it on again and fight for her freedom. Not before. His piece said, Miki folded his napkin, placed it across his plate, and bowed, the picture of politeness even under these circumstances. Thank you for the delicious dinner, he said. Good night, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry you feel that way, Mr. Kaworu, said Akio regretfully. If my sister is returned to school, and the tournament must be restarted, you will certainly be welcome in it. Miki nodded, acknowledging the welcome, then turned and left the room. I must agree with Miki, said Juri, rising to her feet as well. Your presentation was very well done, but it rings false. I didn't see your sister leave the school, but if Miki says he spoke to her, watched her go, then I believe him. I trust him far more readily than I trust you, end of the world. That's a shame, Akio said, his face growing longer. I thought you a more rational sort of person, Miss Arisugawa, not so easily swayed by hearsay and the misguided sentiments of a young man. Her cool composure undamaged by this jab, Juri repeated the performance with the wine glass, bowed, and said, Thank you for the dinner and the very interesting floor show, Mr. Chairman. If circumstances do force Miki to fight again, I will stand with him. Until then, you may consider this my resignation. You're making a terrible mistake, said Akio. You and Mr. Kaworu both. You're abandoning Anthe when she needs you the most. This whole tournament has been a farce, Juri replied, and you are at the heart of all that has made it so. It pleases me to know that your ultimate goal, whatever it was, has been so frustrated that you feel you must resort to this transparent ploy. She smiled sardonically and added, After all the clever tricks you've played over the past year, seeing you brought to this almost has the flavor of a miracle. With a nod to the others and one last, shallow, almost insulting bow, she too turned and departed. Akio sighed disappointedly as she disappeared into the elevator, then looked at the remaining three. "What about you?" he asked. "Will you also be turned away from the path by the hallucinations of a lovesick boy?" "No," said Toga. He reached, picked up the ring, and put it on. "I'm in. I'll find them. Count on it." "I know I'll have your best efforts," said Akio with a faintly mocking smile. Toga returned it, just as mockingly, bowed, and departed. "And what of you, Miss Kiryu?" asked Akio. "Will you join your dear brother in his search, or leave him to go it alone in the wilderness?"
"Toga can take care of himself," Nanami replied, annoyed. Then she picked up the ring anyway. "But I'm going anyhow, on my own. I owe Himemiya a favor."
"Indeed," said Akio, cocking an eyebrow with interest. "I was under the impression that you and my sister didn't get along."
"We didn't," said Nanami shortly, "but you don't have to like someone to learn from them. Good night, Mr. Chairman. I'll be ready to leave in the morning, if that suits you."
"My foolish pride has already wasted 4 months," Akio replied. 12 hours is unlikely to make much difference." Without anything to say to that, Nanami took her leave. Akio and Sayonji sat in silence for several minutes, Akio looking bemused, Sayonji deep in thought, his arms folded across his chest. Finally, Akio broke the silence. "Well, Kyuichi, are you still awake?" Said Sayonji. He looked sidelong at the deputy chairman, his violet eyes cold. "I don't trust you any more than Arisugawa does," he said frankly. "You've manipulated me again and again until I have a hard time remembering which way is up. You've turned the man who was my best friend into a creature I barely recognize, let alone like. You've lied to us all along, and I believe you're lying to us now. Maybe what Kaworu thinks he saw was real, and maybe it wasn't. Either way, you're a liar all the way through." Akio gave him a pleasant look. "And?" "You might have gulled Nanami," Sayonji went on. "If you have, it's hardly an achievement. She's graceless and not very bright. Toga doesn't believe you, though. He's joining your hunt for his own reasons."
Akio smiled and nodded. "Of course, he still wants Tenjo for himself. In his little fantasy world, he's already bested her, rescued the Rose Bride, and taken the prince's role and his failed predecessor, who, of course, will have recognized the error of her ways, as his prizes." He chuckled. "Toga is an idiot." Sayonji didn't argue the point. He merely rose to his feet and turned the full force of his cold violet glare on Akio. "I don't care about power or revolution anymore," he stated flatly. "I won't take your ring. I won't join your hunt. I will find Anthy. But when I do, it won't be to hand her over to you." "Assuming I am the villain you take me for," Akio pointed out, "it's not very smart of you to telegraph your intention to oppose me that way." "I'm finished with your stupid games," Sayonji replied. Turning on his heel, he stalked to the elevator, pressed the button, and entered, the closing doors cutting off Akio's pleasant, "Good night to you too, Kyuichi," behind him. On the way down, he fumed. What was the bastard playing at this time? What had really happened that night? Was what Kaworu said about Anthy leaving true? And if so, why hadn't she come and said goodbye to him? Their relationship had had its ups and downs, but he'd cared for her whatever happened. With a sudden, noisy jolt, the elevator stopped, the lights going out. "Wah," said Sayonji, looking around in puzzlement. "Damn," he muttered. The emergency light failed to come on, but the button for the ground floor was still lit. From its bleeding glow, he located the door's open button and pressed it a couple of times. Nothing. Then, with another jolt, it began going back up. Sionji's thumbs pricked. What was this? Otori summoning him back to the top, perhaps to deal with him in some violent fashion or another? Could the man actually stoop to murder? A wild thought ran through his mind at that moment. Had Otori, perhaps, killed Tenjo, then somehow arranged for her to be forgotten? If anything could make Anthy flee the school, it would be that. Sionji's fists clenched. He hadn't liked Tenjo much. After all, they were rivals, and he the losing one at that. But he respected her skill, her determination, her courage, and her faith. And Anthy had loved her. That was plain at the end. If Tenjo were dead, Anthy would be grieving. And the thought of that alone was enough to enrage Sionji, like Tenjo or dislike her. The elevator accelerated. Sionji grunted, puzzled, as the G-forces mounted, pressing down on him. What was going on? At this rate, what would happen when the car reached the top of the tower? He pulled out the emergency stop plunger, but nothing happened. He pressed the doors open button once more. No result. The button lights flickered, went out, and he was in total darkness with the roar of the speeding elevator building into a howl around him. This was impossible. He fell to his knees, pressed down as if by the hand of God, his mind racing. By now the elevator should long since have reached the top. He looked up into the darkness above him, his arms quivering with the effort of holding him up. There was a sudden shattering wham, and his world exploded into a kaleidoscopic smear of nothingness. Sionji lurched, grabbing at his head. He tried to cry out in pain, but it only came out as a strangled moan. It was as though recalling up to that point had brought on a recurrence of the trauma itself, as though whatever had happened to him then happened again in his mind as he remembered experiencing it the first time. Azalin was with him in an instant, her hands on his shoulders, feeling his body quivering, as taut as a recurved bow. "Shh, it's okay," she said, drawing him into an embrace, her fingers rubbing across his temples, pushing his own hands away before they tore out handfuls of his long green hair. "You're safe here. You're not in an elevator." "The dream," he whispered. "Brightness, blackness, laughter. Stop this. Stop it. I don't want to be this way."
"Shh, shh,"
Azalin murmured, stroking his head. "You don't have to be anyway. It's just us here, and I won't hurt you. I don't hurt people." "Braiding my old hatreds into a tapestry of madness," Sionji muttered, tears streaking his face. "I don't know how he did it, but it must have been him. It must have always him. It was always him before." "It's okay," Azalin told him patiently. "He's not here. He's back in your old world. He can't reach you here. There's only me here. Only me. Take all the time you need. Take yourself back. Sort out who you are. I'll help you. I'm here for you." "Davanai shatyaya makanai ayainaya." Slowly, hesitantly, as the words still spilled out of him, he put his arms around her, holding her close. She was so warm, warmer than he'd expected, and he was still so cold. She'd lapsed into a language he couldn't understand, but it was so beautiful he didn't care what she was saying. Sionji held her as if his life depended on it, now shivering again, now racked with sobs he couldn't control. Azalin eased him back, got under the covers with him, wrapped them both in warmth, and kissed him over and over again to stop the flow of words, murmuring reassurances in between, in mixed Dantrevis and standard. At length, the warmth, the soothing words, the closeness and unconditional acceptance had their desired effect, smoothing away the panic and allowing his tangled, tortured mind to tumble down into a simpler state, one of reaction and sensation, and then lassitude and rest.
I woke up in my bed, Sayanji said softly, his tone thoughtful as, in a quieter frame of mind, he picked up and began to reweave the tattered tapestry of his memory. I didn't remember any of it. I knew we'd had the letters, that we'd all but Toga decided not to go and then gone, but I couldn't remember the meeting at all. Just going to the tower, sitting down to dinner, and waking up the next day. But I knew it was missing. I knew something had been tampered with. I could feel the edges of the hole there, and little fragments of it were floating around, dissociated from everything else. Next day, I called the council together. Nanami had already left. I asked the others if they remembered what had happened. Toga just gave me that superior smile and said nothing of any consequence. It was just a thank you for participating type of dinner, but that I had hit the wine a little too hard. Not as hard as those two, though, he said, pointing out Kaworu and Arisugawa. They were looking a bit green, and when questioned, admitted that they couldn't remember anything either. Kaworu had to go and be sick over the rail just from the stress of being asked to try. Toga smirked at us, told us he was leaving for a term of study abroad like his sister, and said to be good and not give away the store while he was gone. And then he left. Azalin hummed and nodded to show she was paying attention. I wasn't satisfied, said Sayanji, remembering it as he retold it. Something about it didn't make sense. Something about Arisugawa told me she had the same impression, but she was so sick there was no use talking to her about it, and Kaworu was a complete blank. Not only had we forgotten what we'd been shown, we'd forgotten the things the show had made us remember. I wandered around in a daze for almost a week. To try and clear my thoughts, I went camping in the Forest of Secrets. On the fifth night, I had a dream that brought some of it back to me. But it was the wrong part. I remembered Otori's fiction. The dream was of that little drama he showed us, of Tenjo striking down Anthe and then disappearing with her. That imagery, exploding, context-free, into the vacuum of the gap in my mind, galvanized me into action. I picked up my sword and precious little else and just walked away that night, out into the city, down the mountain, clean out of civilization. By midday the next day, I was halfway to Maerskut. I didn't have a goal. I didn't have a plan. I had nothing but my blade and a burning need to find Anthe and avenge her mistreatment. He chuckled bitterly. I'm sure Tenja would find that amusing. Funny thing, said Azalin. She was actually worried about you. She told us at dinner last Sunday, a couple of days before she and Katie left, that just before she left her old school, you'd actually had your stuff together. Acting more or less like a real person, I think was what she said. That wrung another chuckle, this one not quite so bitter, out of Sayanji. Yes, well, he said wryly, I'd stopped associating with Toga by then. At any rate, I was crossing the great desert, still driven by the mad spark that the dream had struck within me, when suddenly reality turned inside out and I was here. Standing out there, he gestured toward the quad, in the night and snow, where I had moments before been under the beating sun in the middle of the wasteland. I was confused. Who wouldn't be? Said Azalin sympathetically. I felt a strange calling toward the building on the corner, he went on, but it was locked and I couldn't get in. So I went for a walk, trying unsuccessfully to get my thoughts in order. My mind was spinning and wouldn't stop. I don't know how much ground I covered. Eventually it was day and I was back here. I followed the calling into the wedge and up to the fourth floor. Someone had left the door to the stairway open. I followed it to a room in the middle of the hall, and there on the door was a name I remembered, but didn't know why I remembered. But you'd seen her again, Azalin pointed out. You had that part of the dream.
I couldn't remember who she was, Sayanji said. I didn't care who she was. She'd struck Anthy, hurt her, taken her away. That was all I cared about. It wasn't until I saw the name that the rest came back. I knocked, but she wasn't there, and her roommate drove me away. I left as much to try to sort out the new thoughts racing around in my head as to get away from the glare she gave me. Katie can be pretty intimidating when she's actually annoyed, Azalin agreed. It's a good thing she doesn't get that way very often. Sayanji nodded. I wandered again. I'm not sure how long I wandered. Thinking. The more I tried to push the pieces back into order, the more jumbled they got. Finally, out there... He gestured at the window again. What is that place called?
The Quad, said Azalin.
Thank you. On the Quad, I saw her, and something snapped. I saw her, and she was alone. Then I remembered what I had thought in the elevator as it rushed upward, except I remembered it wrong. Suppose Tenjo had killed Anthy. Rage blinded me. I had to know. I struck, then and there, without thinking, with everything all out of its proper place and the order of things completely confused. He shook his head, pressed the heels of his hands to his eyes. It's a good thing her roommate is as brave and skillful as she is. The beating she handed me kept me from committing a terrible mistake. I kept asking where Anthy was, all the while blind to the obvious fact that if Tenjo knew where she was, she'd be out there with her, not here.
Well, at least you figured it out now, said Azalin with a grin. Better late than never, as humans say.
Sayonji blinked at her, puzzled by that remark, then let it pass and said, I fled, defeated, and found my way to the place where you discovered me. I've been there ever since, trying to put my mind in order. The more I tried, the worse it got.
He looked at her, amazement on his face. But by explaining it to you, I think I may have actually made sense of it, or at least what sense there is to be made. I still don't know what happened on the last night of the tournament, or what's happened to Anthy, or how I got here, or what Otori is really up to, but I feel as if I'm me again.
He smiled wryly. More or less like a real person.
That's a start, Azalin agreed. She splayed a hand across his chest and told him, I think you'd be a pretty good real person.
He smiled and raised his hand to take hers, then took a closer look at it and blinked again.
What happened to your hand? He wondered.
Nothing, she replied. Why?
You've only three fingers, he said.
So? So has every other Dantrovian.
The people of your country are all missing a finger?
Country?
She gave him an odd look, then laughed.
No, no. Didn't you pay attention to the book? I'm not from this planet.
Sayanji turned his head to stare at her.
You're not human?
She smirked at him. Could a human do this? She asked, and did something creative with the tail that, until that moment, he hadn't noticed she had.
His eyes bugged out a little bit. Then he chuckled, then laughed outright.
Oh, brave new world, he said, that has such people in it.
Sephiro has no other worlds, he explained. As far as we know, we are alone in our sky. I've never encountered a non-human before.
Ah, encountered. Is that what they're calling it these days? Said Azalin, making him blush a little.
Sorry, she added seriously. I didn't think of it. Hope you're not all freaked out now. I had a lot of fun, and I think it even worked, which is always a plus.
Worked?
She explained, as best she could in a short conversational speech, the nameless, animist religion of Dantrov, and its belief in the healing power of the sharing of joyous energies.
Interesting, said Sionji, because what he was really thinking would have taken too long to say, and would have meant the same thing anyway, after analysis. Anyway, he was too sleepy to say anything much more incisive. "I'm not all freaked out now," he told her after gathering his thoughts for a second. "And I think it worked, too. And I had a lot of fun, too. And I'm not cold anymore." He chuckled wryly. "This kind of thing is a joke where I come from. What that guy needs is..." "Yeah," said Azalin with a faintly irritated tone. "It's the same joke here. I guess some things are universal to human culture. I don't think it's so funny, though."
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you," said Sionji, his voice now markedly drowsy. "What struck me as funny was the notion that it may be a cliché, because it is uncomfortably close to truth."
She might have debated that further. It was a subject that both irritated and fascinated her with regard to human psychology. But he'd fallen asleep. Azalin smiled, adjusted her mental sleep clock to suit his human cycle, and followed him. Sionji stayed with Azalin for 3 very pleasant days, reading, playing several different, rather odd, variants of chess, honing out the nick he'd put in his blade, whacking it against the stone of Bancroft Tower's parapet, talking, and occasionally, encountering. "By the way," Azalin asked as she watched him hone his blade, "where'd you get that sword? Katie broke the one you brought with you, and you left it behind." Sionji blinked as if it had never occurred to him, and regarded the Tachi with surprise. "You know, you're right. Where did I get this?" He closed his eyes, thinking. "I went straight to the tower from the quad. I'd seen it before, while I was wandering the area, trying to remember why the name Tenjo was so important. After that, things are kind of a blur." His eyes opened wide, startled. Then he shook his head. "No, that's impossible."
"What's impossible?" she asked, interested.
"Well, thinking about it, I could swear I had another visitor before you appeared. Sometime that same day, I think. A big, white-bearded old man in red. It seems to me he gave me the sword. Told me something to the effect of, 'Put this to work for a better cause than the last one served,' and then went way up those stairs I chased you up."
He shook his head, laughing.
"But that's ridiculous. I certainly haven't been a good enough boy for Father Christmas to bring me a weapon of this quality. I must have stolen it from somewhere in my delirium. Though where I could have stolen such a fine sword around here, I'm not sure."
He hefted it in his hands, studying the temper line. "It does feel as if it were made for me."
"Oh, you have Christmas in Sephiro, too?"
"Hmm," he said, nodding as he returned to his work. "Judging by the book you loaned me, it's one of several holidays our worlds have in common, though the reasons your people have for calling it Christmas are a bit puzzling."
"Well, not my people," said Azalin. "We call it Dvizhlizhai, but nobody else can even pronounce that."
Sionji chuckled. "I'd be afraid to hurt myself even trying." She threw a pillow at him. He parried it handily, then blinked along with her as its 2 neatly divided halves fell to the floor.
"Oops," he said. "Sorry."
Edward Tavruski and Ayn dropped by on the second day, then returned on the 3rd with a set of identity documents for him. He didn't ask where she'd acquired them. The 4 of them went shopping. He didn't ask where she'd gotten the money in his credit union account either. What few pangs of conscience all this brought him were soothed by the fact that it was, after all, for a good cause, and surely cost whatever bank it had been taken from less than the official welfare system would have taken in taxes to achieve the same end. On the 29th, he shouldered his new duffel bag and kissed Azalin fondly goodbye.
"I can't impose on you any more," he told her.
Anyway, your roommate and the others will be back soon, and it's doubtless they won't be very happy to see me.
I'll explain to them that you're feeling better when I can get them all together, she promised. Will you be around? Your best chance of getting home is probably to stick close to Utina. If she really did come here without wanting to, then you can bet she's trying to figure out a way back, especially if that other girl is still there.
You'd never heard of any of that before I told you, hmm?
Azalin shook her head. She doesn't talk about her past. I think Katie knows. They had a long talk about something after you happened, and whatever it was, it made them closer, so it must have been really important. But she's not that close to the rest of us. We're friends, but that's a best friends kind of story.
Sionji nodded, then gave a wry smile. Does that make us best friends?
I guess maybe that depends on whether you disappear and I never see you again, she replied.
His smile ceased to be wry. I won't be far, he said. Once you've made it safe for me to be seen around here, I won't be far at all.
Then maybe it does, she said. Listen, I don't want you to get the wrong idea about what we've done the last few days. It was good, and it was fun, and I think it was important, but...
He nodded. I understand. And thank you, he added. You have helped me, more than I can say.
Well, don't start thinking you owe me anything, she said with mock severity. There's just nothing more annoying than that.
Sionji smiled again. All right. Do we owe each other nothing, then?
Nothing but the regular debts of friendship, she said, holding out a hand.
Sionji shook it, then hugged her again and kissed her forehead. Take care, Azalin Dvirnatashkin, he said, pronouncing her name almost right. I'll see you soon. Then he came to attention, pivoted smartly on his heel to face the hallway, and announced, Onward, to a new era of glory and honor. Kyuichi Sionji, forward, march! So saying, his back ramrod straight, he marched down the hall with comical gravity to the stairs, on his way to see what sort of place he could make for himself in this strange new world. Azalin, grinning, watched him go, then went back into her room. A couple of hours to kill, and then she could call New Avalon and wish Utina a happy birthday. Wasn't she going to be surprised at what was waiting for her when she got back to school? Airy Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Azalin's Winter Holiday. The Symphony will return.